Hi, everybody. My name is Donna, and I'm an alcoholic. I can't tell you how excited I am to be here. I have never felt so welcomed and so loved, and I have fallen in love with Georgia, I got to tell you. I sat out this morning in the lobby. Patty was going to take me shopping, of course. I needed to get something, and I was sitting out there for, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, and there wasn't a single person that walked in that door that didn't say, good morning. Not a single one, whether they were with our conference or not. It's just been amazing. I mean, they're just so loving and so embracing, and I just appreciate it so much. One of the things, though, when I first met Patty, I mean, I was still pulling my bag off the curb, and she said, well, I can tell you're from Montana by your accent. And I said, do I have an accent? And she said, oh, yeah. And I was like, you have an accent. We've been a couple of places. Stopped at S&S Cafeteria for lunch one afternoon, and the guy behind the counter was asking me something real fast. And I was like, excuse me? And he said it again, and I looked at Patty like, help! I don't speak Georgia. And so she said, he asked you if you wanted gravy. I was like, okay. Anyway, it's just been so wonderful to be here, and I've so enjoyed every single one of the speakers. Sandy is a dear friend of mine from way back, and it's just been so good to be able to catch up with her again. And Earl and I spoke at my very first speaking commitment, and this had to be 25 years ago. And it was at a place called Beaver, Utah. And we were in a fairgrounds, like right in the middle of a racetrack. And you had to climb this ladder 30 feet in the air. I mean, and there was nothing but a ladder and a podium about this big and nothing to hold on to. I mean, well, you had rails, but, you know, so I'm scared to death. This is my first shot. My sponsor said, you're going to do it. And I said, well, what if I'm terrible at it? She said, don't worry. They won't ask you back. Matter of fact, I've never been back to Beaver, Utah. So, anyway, okay, I have a joke for you. Now you have to just go with me, okay? Trust me. There's this young woman in the hospital. She's a brand new Candy Striper volunteer, and she's giving a bed bath to this gentleman who's wearing a full face oxygen mask. And he says to her, are my testicles black? And she's brand new and so shy. And she said, oh, I don't do any of that. I just wash your arms and your chest and your neck and your face, and I'll wash your legs and such, but that's all I do. And he says, no, are my testicles black? And she said, oh, well, I'll have to get my supervisor. I don't really know what to do. And he said, wait a minute. And he pulls the mask away and he said, are my test results back? So there's my joke. Thank you, honey. I'm getting over a terrible cold, so I may end up coughing, but I'm leaving that in God's hands. I'm just going to do my best here today. I'm so excited to be with you and to share with you in a general way what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I'm like now. And I was a kid who grew up in Billings, Montana, scared to death of everything, scared of everyone. I sponsor a woman who says that her attitude when she was growing up was, no, and you can't make me. And I wish I'd have had an attitude like that, but I didn't. I wanted to be invisible. I wanted to hide. I came from a home of a lot of abuse, a lot of violence. And my idea was to just cut my losses and stay out of trouble and keep my mouth shut. I suffered from a delusion, this may sound familiar, that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this life if I only managed well. And I had that concept in my head from the time I was a little kid. My idea was that if I could be as good as possible, if I could get the right grades and have the right friends and be cute enough and whatever, that they would love me, God would protect me, and I'd be safe. And that was the idea that I had. And I carried that with me, actually, well into sobriety. I thought being good should earn me something. So as a kid, I set out to be as good as I could possibly be so that I would earn God's favor. Now, as a little kid, I'm telling you, I was seeking a power greater than myself from the time I was very young. I remember being 7 years old and standing in my backyard, and one day a light went on, and I looked around and I thought, what are we doing here? What is this for? What are we supposed to be doing? I mean, at 7 years old, I'm already looking for, like, the meaning of life. You know, my sponsor used to tell me, you ask questions that there's no answers for. And I said, well, that doesn't keep me from asking the questions. You know, I have to know, what am I supposed to be doing? So I didn't have an answer for that, so my idea was be good. So I tried that. I tried to be as good as possible, and it just didn't matter how much I tried. I could never quite be good enough. I always fell short. I came from a family of a lot of alcoholism. My father was the alcoholic in our home, and he was a violent man, and he was full of fear and anger. In fact, that was me. From the time I'm little, I was a kid that had this pile of anger and guilt and fear and shame and self-loathing and secrets. That was me before I ever picked up a drink. And it turns out that was my dad, too. You know, he felt like he had to be 10 times better than everybody else just to stand on the floor next to a guy. I was the oldest of 4 kids, and so I got a lot of the abuse. You know, again, stick with me, it gets better. When I was quite a lot older. I was 5 years older than my brother, and 9 years older than my next sister, and 10 years older than the next one. So when I left home at 17, they were just kids. And I really didn't get to know them until we were adults. I left home at 17 years old, and I was terrified. I had never been to a dance or a football game. I'd never been on a date. I didn't know how other people did things. I was about as awkward and backward as you could be. And of course, you know, you just fake it. I was used to that. I used to do it, as you know, in school. I mean, I'd come home, I'd go to school at the beginning of the year and tell people about these wonderful vacations that we took or what we did last weekend, because they had stories like that. Well, we didn't do any of that stuff, but I just wanted to fit in. So my dad strange thing about my dad, he didn't drink until he was 32. But he was an untreated, sober alcoholic all that time. And I didn't know why. I didn't know why he was so violent and explosive. I didn't understand why I was always getting the beatings, you know, why that was going on. I just figured it was my fault. This is what I deserve. This is what I got coming. So anyway, when I was 17, my dad got caught. And at that time, like I said, I had no worldly experience whatsoever. But I had experienced every kind of abuse that you can have in an alcoholic home. There was, you know, mental and emotional and spiritual and sexual and physical, every kind of abuse. And when I was 17, my dad got caught. And we ended up leaving town in the middle of the night. It's about to get better. Hang in there with me. We left town in the middle of the night and moved to Northern California. And I was taken out of school and put to work. And I was working, I did okay, and right after I turned 18, right after I turned 18, or 19, I decided that I was going to go back to Billings and have Christmas with my friends. I only had a couple, but I went back to Billings. I put everything I owned in a little cardboard box and caught a Greyhound bus and went back to Billings. And I was, you know, I was real feeling very adult and independent. Still didn't have a drink. I had no answers, no idea how to deal with life. No clue. But I had a girlfriend who said, hey, we're having a little Christmas party tonight, and there's this guy I want you to meet. And so, and I was not happy about that. I didn't have good luck with guys. I was, you know, very awkward and clumsy. And but I went to the party, and in walks God's will for my life. Oh, it was clear as a bell. I mean, he was home on leave from the Navy. He was a tight little unit. He had nice little butt. And I just, you know, I didn't treat him very nicely. I acted like I didn't care about him at all. And after about the second day of hanging out together, he started acting like he didn't care about me. Well, now that's not going to happen. So, you know, he's not interested in me. Well, that changed my tune. I knew him for 3 weeks. He was home on leave. And before he got ready to leave to go back to Charleston, South Carolina, he asked me to marry him. Now, I don't know if you know this. Pay attention. But if someone asks you to marry him, you must say yes. Because you could offend someone if you don't. And so I knew him 3 weeks. I don't think I even knew his middle name. But he asked me to marry him, and what I know is that Charleston, South Carolina is a long ways from Billings, Montana. And I can go somewhere and be someone else. That's what I know. Without even taking a drink. Didn't even take a drink. I married this man, and we had 5 children in 6 years and 3 months. And I was busy. I had stuff to do, you know. I had 4 beautiful girls and a boy. I didn't have the first clue how to be a mother or a wife. I just had no idea. I hadn't even begun to address the problems that I had with myself and my life or my childhood. And here I am trying to be a mom to these gorgeous little kids. And what ended up happening in short order was that when my oldest was 6 and my youngest was 9 months old, he had an affair. And I said, adios. And I went to work in the cowboy bars. And I can tell you just as sure as I'm standing here today that what I found when I started putting alcohol in me on a regular basis was a power greater than myself that made life work for me for the first time. I could really be somebody else. I didn't have to be that scared little kid from Billings, Montana that didn't know what everybody else knew. I could be somebody else. And that's what I wanted. That's what booze gave to me. It allowed me to do something and be something that I didn't have to be ashamed of. Of course, that changed. You know, how you have to live as an alcoholic woman or an alcoholic man, it soon makes you ashamed. My sponsor is Polly P. And she says, And she says that men hate what they have done and women hate what they've become. And I gotta say that in my experience, I certainly began to hate what I was becoming. And by the time the end of my drinking career, if you want to call it that, I was full of self-loathing. I absolutely detested myself. And I always had, really. I hated myself. So anyway, I had these 5 gorgeous little kids. I don't know what to do with them. And I knew how to feed them and keep a clean house and how to dress them and bathe them and line them all up in a row, and that was about it. You know, there's this is what I call my snapshot. This is about how much I knew about being a wife and a mother. When I was a kid growing up, my mom used to buy her eggs from the guy that lived down the road that had a whole bunch of chickens. So when the egg cartons are empty in our house, she didn't throw them away. She put them on top of the fridge. And when she had like three or four, she'd go down the road and buy the eggs. Well, I didn't really think about this a lot. My husband and I had been married about 6 months, and I had a whole mess of egg cartons on top of the fridge. And one day he said to me, "What are you saving those for?" And I'm telling you, I remember it clear as a bell. I said, "I don't know. That's where they go." You know? I mean, honest to God, that was... I knew to do the right things, the non-abusive things, the non-threatening things. I knew to do those things. But I didn't have a clue about being a wife or a mother, and I was, you know, I was a mess. I was a mom that neglected and abused and cherished and loved my kids all at the same time. I'm the mom who would walk in the house one day and wrap my arms around him and say, "My God, you're just so beautiful and wonderful, and I love you so much, and you can do anything in this world that you put your mind to." But the next day I might walk in and smack somebody because there's a shoe in the middle of the floor. You know, when you grow up in an alcoholic home, you never know what you're going to get. It's just, it's a draw every time. You just don't know. And that's the kind of mom that I was. We were divorced. He had an affair with my friend, and we got divorced, and my kids were all still really little, and I began my drinking career then. About 2 years into that, I gave my middle daughter and my only son to him to raise, because frankly, honestly, I couldn't live like I wanted to live and take care of those five kids. That's the truth. That's not what I told myself. What I told myself was, you know, Daniel is the only boy, and he really needs to have a father figure in his life, so I'm going to give him to his dad. And Tawny just mourns for her father every single day. Plus, you know, Daniel shouldn't be an only child coming from a family of five children. So I think I'll send the two of them. And the truth of it is, that was the most selfish, destructive decision I ever made. And I my sobriety date is the 5th of May, 1987. I am 30 years sober, and it wasn't until the last few years that some healing at depth really began to happen. I mean, we began to heal all along. We have progressed and forgiven and loved and hated and, you know, the whole thing. I've had phone calls from my daughters saying, "You know what, you had a chance and you blew it. And we don't want to know you. You were a lousy mother and you're done." I've had to answer calls like that. I sat down to the computer and she said, "I don't want to hear from you ever again." So I couldn't call her. I had to honor what she requested. So I sat down at the computer and I composed an email and I called my sponsor and read it to her before I took any action. And what I said in that email is, "On the day that you were born," this is my oldest daughter, "on the day that you were born, there was no one on earth that was less equipped to be a mother than me. And that is not your fault. I took from you your childhood. You had to grow up and forget about being a kid because you had to step in and be a mom to the other kids. You have every right to be angry. Every right. I understand completely. I want you to know that I'm no longer that person. And if you ever want to talk to me, if you ever have questions you want to ask me, please call. I would be happy to answer your questions. I'll stand right there in front of you and look you in the eye." And I read it to Polly, and she said, send it, and I did. And a few days later, I got a call from her, from Trina, and she was crying, and she said, Mama, I love you so much. You know, it's that love-hate thing. There's so much damage done by alcoholism. I was sober quite a while before I even began to grasp the extent of the damage that I had done in my family. I mean, I knew that I lied to him. I knew that I said, I'll be back in 2 hours, and I was lucky to get there by 2 a.m. or not till the next morning. You know, I knew that I stole from them, that I stole time from them and money from them. You know, I did my grocery shopping one day at a time. I didn't go buy groceries for a week because I needed drinking money. So I'd figure out, well, what did you guys like for dinner tonight? They'd say whatever they wanted, and I'd go get it, thinking I'm just the greatest mom ever. I'm so liberal. I'll just let them decide what they want. They wanted a mother. They deserved to have a mother. They deserved to have somebody that was taking care of them. They didn't need to have somebody to condone them. And I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful for the recovery that I've experienced here and for the healing in my family. And not just myself and my children, but between myself and my parents and my siblings. It's been a hard road. It's been a real hard road. It took a lot longer than I thought it should. But I'm so grateful for the healing that has taken place. So anyway, I lost my place. Just take a drink. Anyway, I lost my children because of my drinking. 1 year at Christmas, they went to visit their dad. And they told him, Mom is really in trouble. And she needs help. And she won't get it if we're there. And so he said, well, that's just fine. You're going to stay here. And he was supposed to show up with them on January 2nd. And he showed up, but he didn't have them with him. And it was a weird thing because it was kind of like, you know, the gig is up. My hand is tipped. Finally, everybody knows that I'm a drunk and a boozer, and I just can't hold it together. And he said, I'm keeping the kids. They'll come back when you're better. And I remember thinking, 6 months. Maybe 6 months. If I could stay sober for 6 months, I could have my kids back. And, you know, there's a place in the book that says the most powerful desire to stop is of absolutely no avail. And I had a powerful desire to stop. And I started trying to get sober back then. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time in February of 1981. And I was a long ways from having my last drink. I probably had to raise my hand to the newcomer something like 30 times, honestly. Honest to God, it was over and over and over. And I went to treatment once. Treatment gave me 28 days. That's something I couldn't get by myself. And I came out of treatment and I was holding on for dear life. I didn't want to drink. I wanted my kids back. I needed them. They're the only thing in my life that kept me here on earth. They were my only reason for living. And it was just killing me to not have them. And their dad was really bitter. And you know, when I came into AA, I would complain about him. About, you know, I called the kids and asked them to go to a movie this weekend or whatever, something, you know, do something with the kids and take them roller skating or something. And he wouldn't let them go. And I'd be so angry. I'd be like, why do you torture me with those children? And there was an old-timer in the meeting who said to me one day, well, I wonder how many nights a guy has to get up and hold his little girl who's crying for her mama before he gets angry. And I'd never thought of that before. I looked at how injured I was. and how undervalued I was. And it took me a long time to come to terms with that stuff. Anyway, I started trying to get sober, and you know, God bless Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless the people. I used to hear them talk about, we stand on the shoulders of giants. And I thought, oh, poo. You know, they talk about these old-timers like they're something special. You know, all they did was, they didn't drink and they didn't die. That's all to it. But, you know, thank God for them. Over the years, I have been given a life that is truly beyond my wildest dreams. And I've been able to survive things that I know I would never have lived through. I got sober in Kona, Hawaii. I moved over there with 6 months of sobriety. I was going to stay with my best drinking buddy, who was still drinking. But it's okay, because I'm sober. I got her. Got this covered. So I move over there, and I lived with her for about a month. And she drank, and I didn't. And then I got my own little apartment. I had a couple of jobs, and I'm making money. And I get to a point about a year into it. 13 and a half months, as a matter of fact. And I called my oldest daughter. Her birthday is the day after mine. And we had always celebrated our birthdays together. And I called her and said, Trina, why don't you come on over to Kona and we'll celebrate our birthdays together. And she just thought that sounded great. So I brought her to Kona and we did everything. We ate everything. We saw everything. We swam everywhere. We did the whole deal. And I, you know, this is an alcoholic's best thinking, right? My plan, and we always have a plan, my plan was to ply her with all this wonderful experiences during our vacation, and then to ask her to let me come back home and they could live with me again. And towards the end of her visit, I said, you know, Trina, I've got a bunch of money saved. I can come back to Billings and get a house and you guys can come home. And she looked at me and she said, Mom, we don't want to live with you anymore. And I was devastated. I mean, that was my whole reason for staying sober. You can't get sober for somebody else. I was crushed. She left, and it wasn't 2 weeks, and I picked up a drink. Now, I'll tell you what I was doing and what I wasn't doing. The new people that are here, please pay attention. If you're within your first 80 years of sobriety... These are tried and true methods. Trust me. excuse me. Anyway. I was going to meetings constantly. I was going to meetings like 2 or 3 times a day. I didn't have a sponsor. Why would I need a sponsor? I didn't do the steps. I read them. They looked pretty easy to understand to me. I didn't read the book. I prayed a lot, though. And I kept begging God to help me to stay sober. But when I lost my reason for being sober, here's one thing. You know how when you come into they talk about in AA meetings about being as sick as your secrets? I thought that meant, oh my God, I'm going to have to tell them about all that really shameful, horrible stuff that I did. And but that's not true. There's another way of looking at that. And here's the example. I didn't know that when I went into the meeting at night and they said, how are you? I didn't know that if I said, man, I'm hurting so bad. I miss my kids so much, I just feel like I'm going to die. I'm just in pain all the time. I dream about them. I think about them constantly, and I'm afraid that I'll never get them back. I didn't know that if I told you that secret, that you would say, oh yeah, I remember that kind of stuff. That happened to me too when I was so newly sober. Here's what I did. Here's something I tried. I didn't know that if I told you my secrets, those kind of secrets, that you had solutions for those things. And so instead, I go in the meeting and they'd say, how you doing, Donna? I'd say, good, I'm good. And I kept my secrets. And they almost killed me. I got more and more desperate. After I picked up a drink, I couldn't stay sober. I'd be sober for like a week and then get drunk for a day and then be sober for 2 weeks and get drunk for one night and then I'd get sober. You know what I mean? Over a period of 6 months, I think I got drunk about 4 or 5 times. But still, it was horrible. It was torturous. I wouldn't call it sobriety. I was putting as many days together as I could before I drank, but I knew I would drink. I always drank. That's what I do. And in Kona, they had this really annoying habit of saying, is there anyone here for their first meeting since their last drink? And then everybody looks at me to see if I'm going to raise my hand today, because I always raised my hand. Anyway, one night I was at the meeting. It's torn down now, but it was an open pavilion, open air pavilion. And I was sitting in the back of the meeting, and this guy that I really hated, Frank, was leading the meeting. Frank was annoying. Oh my gosh, he was always picking on me. He was always just, you know, what I know today is that he was trying to knock me off center so that he could get some reaction or something, you know? But I didn't know that. I thought he was just obnoxious. So one night he says to me, so what are you doing, chicken? That's what he called me. What are you doing, chicken? What are you doing for your sobriety? And I said, well, I pray. I pray a lot. And he said, yeah? Well, you and your God are going to get drunk. And I was like, what? I can't believe you said that to me. I was appalled. I was just like incensed. And he said, what you're doing isn't working. And I just talked to the hand, you know. I didn't want to hear anything from him. So I stormed away. Well, this night at this meeting, he was leading the meeting. And at the end of the meeting, I'm sitting in the back of the room with my best dare to get me sober look. And he says, is there anybody here that has a burning desire? Right at the last of the meeting. He never did that. But he looked at me. And I said, yeah, you know what, Frank? I got a burning desire for you, buddy. I said, you make me sick. You people all make me sick. You're always telling me that sober is better and sober doesn't feel better to me. I hate this. I hate it. I come in here and you're all, oh, I've never had it so good. I'm thrilled for you. But I hate it. I hate the way I feel. I hate my life. I hate myself. I don't see anything getting any better. You talk about the promises. Oh, really? Promises? No. No promises happening here. I just kind of barfed on the meeting, you know? I just kind of like, blah! And when I shut up, there was sort of a silence that went over the room, and somebody said, right on, Donna, keep coming back. And I'm like, man, you people are weird. You are weird. And when I was done, the meeting was over, and right after that, this new guy, who had a year and was on fire for AA, came bouncing up to me. You know how they are. They're just so stinking happy, you can hardly stand to look at them. And he said, how long has it been since you drank? And I said, 45 days. And he said, well, what makes you think it isn't working? And I was like, was I going too fast for you, buddy? I mean, let me tell you, you guys love this. You come in here, oh, huggy, huggy, kissy, kissy. In Hawaii, they do that. They kiss you, which is bad enough if they hug. But they kiss you. Oh, I've never had it so good. Oh, I'm happy, joyous, and free. You know, I just can't stand it. I said, none of that's happening for me. And this was a magic moment. He picked up a 12 and 12, and he opened it to the seventh step, and he showed me one sentence. And it said, in every case, pain had been the price of admission into a new life. In every case. And I was like, fine. You know, maybe what I'm going through isn't for nothing. And honest to God, it didn't bring me a lot of relief, but it just bought me one more day. Next day I went to a meeting, and there was a woman behind the podium that I'd never seen before. She had just hit the island. Her name was Phyllis C, and she died a long time ago. She used to run around with Chuck Chamberlain and Johnny Harris when he was new, and, you know, Clancy when he was living in his car, and, you know, she had, I think, 27 years of sobriety then. She got sober when she was 36. She was the kind of woman that when she walked in the room, she just kind of lit the place up. She just had this infectious smile. She had this cute little gap between her two front teeth, and I just thought that was so cute. She had long, frizzy hair, and she tied it up in big silk scarves, and she wore a bunch of jewelry, and I just fell in love with that woman. She talked about who she was before she picked up a drink. She didn't use the same words that I do, but she talked about the mountain of anger and guilt and fear and shame and self-loathing and secrets. And she said, that's who I was before I ever picked up a drink. And when I took a drink of alcohol, it appeared to make it go away. And I could be somebody else. And I just thought, oh my God, you know, she knows how I've lived. She had two boys. One of them stuttered real bad. And she said, every time that little guy opened his mouth and tried to talk, I felt like I had done that to him. And I knew exactly what it felt like to hate what you've been as a mother or what you haven't been. And she was the same age that I was right that night. I just remember thinking, man, if there was just some way I could not drink, maybe I could have some of that one of these days. And she was just an inspiration. I was with her the next day on the beach. That night, though, she talked about, her husband had just died of brain cancer. And she had some old-timer friends that lived in Kona, and they said, come on over, Phyllis, and let us just love on you for a while. She'd been a caregiver for Johnny, and she had colon cancer. And when she came over there from the podium, she goes, it's the most expensive thing I've ever worn, and I can't show anyone. I mean, she just had this crazy sense of humor, you know. And I loved her. I just loved that. I got it. Anyway, the next day I was asking her, I said, you know, Phyllis, I probably need to do another fourth step, right? And she said, no, baby, you just need to do a first step. And I said, I don't get it. You know I'm an alcoholic. I know my life's unmanageable. What do you mean? And she said, there's implied action in the first step. And she said that the implied action is that you need to find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. And I was like, no problem. You know, I'd been to churches when I was a kid. I knew about God with a capital G. And so she said, oh, great. Well, tell me about your higher power. So I told her about Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. You know, that's what I knew about God. And she interrupted me. Now, I knew that she was a religious woman. But she interrupted me. And she said, wait a minute. She said, any God that you can understand will be too small for your needs. And I'd never heard that before. She said, you've been trying to do this a long time, and it's not working. She said, maybe you should consider something else. And I was like what? And she said, think about this. When you go to sleep at night, your lungs inflate and deflate all night long, and your heart beats all night long, and there's nothing that you do before you go to bed that makes that happen. And I said, okay. She said, when your time on this earth is up, there is nothing you could do to add one more minute to your time on this planet. When your time is up, you're gone. And I said, okay. And she said, that is a power greater than yourself. That's something you didn't create and you can't control. And she said, if you wake up in the morning and you're breathing then God loves you as if you were his only child. And I'm telling you, you know, she could have said a lot of things, but when she said the only child, I was grieving my kids so bad. I remember thinking if I could find a God that loved me half as much as I love those kids, I bet it would do it for me. I said, what do I do? And she said, tonight when you're alone, you get on your knees and say a prayer like this. Don't use my words. Put it in your own words. But the thing you want to say is something like, God, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you want from me. But if you want anything to do with what's left of my life, then come on, because I don't know where to go from here. And I remember thinking, man, that's probably the most honest prayer I've ever heard. You know, there's no bargaining. There's no, I'll be good. You know, I won't ever do it again, I promise. It was just honest. It was just like, if you're there and you want to do the deal, then let's do the deal. And that's exactly was the beginning of a tiny little opening of willingness, you know, in that direction. Because I always came at it from what I'd been taught, you know. And I was taught that if you even question these things, you're burning in hell, you know, with big veins bulging from the forehead and all that. It was insurmountable to me before that. And I want to tell you that sobriety, you know, I said earlier that I got sober the 5th of May, 1987, and I can't even believe it. I mean, I just can't even believe it. It just blows my mind. You know, I go to this meeting that gets quite a few newcomers, and when somebody asks me, how long are you sober? I say, I hate to tell you. Because it's going to seem like, oh, yeah, forget it, you know? I remember giving a coin to my sponsor who had 33 years, and I cried. And what was going through my head was, I will never make it. I didn't even care about being 33. I was just, you know, just staying sober at all. I was about 4 years sober, and I remember thinking, no, this is too hard, you know? And I was still working on the one day at a time thing. Well, I'll tell you what, life can be hard sometimes. Two of my children have died since I've been sober. In 1995, my son Daniel was a month after his 19th birthday. He had been struggling with alcoholism and drugs. And he got to a place one day where he just couldn't do the fight anymore. Just a young man like that. And he jumped off a cliff and took his life. And it's like I'm going down the road, I'm sober, and all of a sudden the terrain has changed. My entire life has changed. I don't know how to act. I don't know how to cope. I don't know what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. Like, can you believe I would even worry about being appropriate? But I did. I was like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to be a mom that lost her son. 2 years and 9 months later, my second daughter, Tracy, died. And she was 5 years sober. And she was married and had a little girl that was almost four. And Tracy caught a virus that melted her heart. And she was, they called her Tracer the Racer. I mean, she was just boom, 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 go, you know. Kind of like me. My husband says I'm fire, fire, aim. Now think about it. I'm like, blam, blam, blam. Did I hit anything? I act before I think a lot of times. And Tracy was sort of like that too. She was a go-getter. And she got this really weird virus, and it killed her. In 4 days, she was gone. And 6 months before Daniel died, my sponsor died. She had 33 years, I told you about. And then Daniel died. Daniel died January 23rd, 1995. And 6 months after that, my other sponsor died, who also had 33 years. And I'm like a fish out of water. I'm just flopping around. I don't know how to, nothing. I lost my total rudder. I started doubting God. I was angry. I was so angry. I mean, here I am. I'm doing all the right stuff, you know. I'm sponsoring women. I'm a good little AA member. I'm responsible. I'm secretary this. I'm treasurer that. I'm involved. I was living in California. I was involved in H&I. I did a lot of corrections work. And I was happy to do it. I was thrilled to do it. It wasn't like, oh, poor is me, you know. I loved it. But I thought that if I did the right stuff, that I would get the right things. I thought that somehow I could earn a good life. I thought that I could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this life if I only managed well. And it was a rude awakening. 6 months after Tracy died, my other sponsor died. A few months later, my husband had an affair. We'd been married 15 years, and I was like, adios. You know, I wasn't going for that. To me, that's a deal breaker. That's just a deal breaker. Not for everybody, but for me it was. And he had an affair with a woman I was sponsoring, and it just, my whole world was a mess. It was just a mess. I felt like everybody around me was dying, and I was blaming God. And at that time is when I got Polly as a sponsor. This was in 1997. So she's been my sponsor for 20 years now. And she said to me one day, she goes, baby, I think you're mad at God. And I was like, I don't want to be mad at God. I mean, it doesn't pay to be mad at God. He doesn't care. he's the big guy, you know. He doesn't feel that stuff. And she said, yeah, I know, but I think you are. And I was like, what do I do? And she says, you just got to keep going. You know, you maintain your commitments, you keep sponsoring, you keep... Here's what happened. All my sponsees left me. Everybody left my life. Everybody was scared to death of me. I was so angry. I mean, have you ever sat next to somebody in a meeting and you can just feel the anger pouring off of them? Well, that was me. And they were loving me. They were praying for me from across the room, you know. They were like, good luck. God bless. And I was flopping around. It was the darkest time of my life. And I was coming home from a meeting one night, and it was a candlelight meeting. It was actually a newcomer meeting, but I felt so raw and so new. I mean, when they'd say, is there anybody here for their first meeting since their last drink? I wanted to raise my hand, even though I hadn't drank, because I felt so new. And I was at this meeting one night, candlelight meeting, California, of course. And this guy said that with 8 years of sobriety, he still carried with him this notion that the reason things like that happened to a little boy, he was talking about his childhood, were because he deserved it. And I'm telling you, I felt like somebody hit me with a bat. It was like, oh my gosh, that's how I feel. I mean, I didn't feel like God was killing my kids to mess with me. It was more like, what made you think this was going to work for you? What made you think there was happy, joyous, and free somewhere? I mean, when has it ever panned out like that? And I was driving home from that meeting that night, and I turned a corner, and the thought went through my mind, and I don't know if this is going to mean anything to you at all, but it changed my life. The thought went through my mind, what if I've been wrong? What if I've been wrong about God? And what if I've been wrong about me? And I'll tell you, if you ever doubt God, if you ever feel like you just can't make that connection, if you ever feel like, you know, there's something lacking there, ask yourself that question, what if I'm wrong? I mean, the book says, see to it, or something about, see to it that the religious people are right, or something like that, make use of what they offer. You know, that's kind of what happened to me that night. It was a realization. I went home that night, and I had under my bed this little box, shoe box, full of stuff. And it had more. It had obituaries of friends that I had that died sober, and it had a cassette tape that Daniel had made for me as a Christmas present, and I didn't get it till March. And it was him singing songs and playing his guitar and saying, "Hey, Mom, Merry Christmas, Merry, Merry Christmas." And there was another tape there from Tracy. I mean, who gets this stuff? Who, you know, I mean, this is like a miracle to me that I even got these things all these months later. It was a cassette tape of Tracy singing "I Will Always Love You" by Whitney Houston. And I mean, she just, my kids are really talented that way. She had just a beautiful voice, and she always won contests singing and such. So anyway, I'm laying all these things out on the bed, and I'm looking at all this stuff and the notes that I had from my kids and some cards from my home group going, "Never thought you'd make it," you know. Not really. Anyway, I look at all this stuff and I thought, you know, Donna, are you in or are you out? You're going to have to make a call here. Are you going to stick around when sobriety is good and the wind's at your back and it's all happening and you like who you are? Or are you going to stick around when you hate every bit of what's going on? And I mean, I made a deal with God that night. Sometimes they say you can't do that. You can't make deals with God. But I did. And what my deal was this. I said, "God, I will do anything you want me to do. I will work anywhere, I will live anywhere, I will do anything, but you have got to give me some peace." And I got to tell you, it wasn't like Bill's experience of the wind of the mountaintop blowing through and through. It wasn't like that, but it was just a little bit better. And the next day, it was just a little bit better. And you know, I wish I could tell you that the rest of things has been easy rolling. It hasn't. I was in a couple of car accidents some years ago. I had traumatic brain injuries. This is my first speaking commitment in probably 3 years. And it wasn't by choice. I mean, it was just like God said, "No, you get to rest now. We're turning off that faucet." So I started getting involved in other areas of service. I became the GSR of my home group. I started going to district. I go to area. You know, I'm still sponsoring women. I mean, I'm just doing wherever God points me. Recently, not quite 2 months ago, I buried my mother. And I have to tell you, my experience with my mom and dad is just incredible. I have just a few minutes left. Jill told me how long I could go. Anyway, when my dad died, now, I had hated him as long as I could remember, for the things that happened to me when I was a kid. But the last 15 years of his life, I was sober. And the women in AA told me what to do. They said, "You need to pay more attention to what kind of daughter you're being to him than what kind of father he was to you." And I was real indignant. I said, "Oh, really? How do I do that?" And they said, "You make sure you send him a card on his birthday and on Father's Day. And, you know, you might not be able to, you don't need to send him a card that says, 'Geez, Dad, you taught me everything I wanted to know.' But you can always find one that says, 'Have a nice day, love ya,' you know." And so I did that. And I didn't do it because I wanted things to heal between me and Dad. I did it because I didn't have another idea. And I was tired of being angry. And I did it for 15 years. I was 15 years sober when he died. And over that period of time, I started to see him for what he really was. He was a suffering alcoholic. The last 25 years of his life, he didn't drink. But he was a long-term, sober, untreated alcoholic. And he was depressed and angry and sad. And I used to try to cheer him up all the time. I'd try to say, "Hey, Dad, you know, it's a beautiful day," and he didn't want to hear it. And the women in AA told me to say things like, "Man, Dad, I'm really sorry that it's this hard. That must feel awful. Just do that. And what happened was, over a period of those years, I became his ally. And I stopped hating him. And I remember one day looking at him going, wow, I don't hate him. When did that go away? Did I hate him yesterday? I mean, I don't remember when it went away. It just went away. I started seeing him for who he was. He was a sick guy, and he carried a big stone. He didn't have a minute of relief in his life. My mom, I had 30 years with her of sobriety, and I adore my mother. Now, I have blamed my mom a lot for the things that happened, because she knew what was going on and she didn't help. And I thought she should have. But the last few years, I mean, in my sobriety, now way back when, I used to give her perms and cut her hair, and I'd take her shopping, I'd do little things like that with her, and you know, that was my making amends. And you know, Chris, you knocked me out the other night when you said I made amends when I gave her a bath, because that was my experience. I got to bathe my mother. I got to wipe her poop off her butt. You know, I got to love her, wash her, and she'd say, oh, that feels so good. And just, it was so painful and so sacred. I adored her. And during the time we had together, we talked about every single thing. There was no stone left unturned. We talked about all of it. And we healed. And man, my mom was like the most humble woman I know. And just brave. And you know what's weird? She didn't die of anything. She just died. She was done. She was tired. She told the doctor one day, she said, you know, she was getting out of the hospital, and they'd been working with her and doing physical therapy and stuff, and he got her walking all the way down the hall and back, and he was feeling like, oh, it's going to be great. And she was trying to tell him, and finally she just looked at me and said, tell him. And I said, she's not talking about the ability to walk down the hall and back. She's talking about the inner strength. She's done. She wants to go home. She doesn't want to be here anymore. And the doctor said, oh my gosh, is she going to harm herself? And I was like, no. And mom said, oh no, you know. But it took her 5 weeks, but she finally passed. It took a long time, and it's a lot of work. It's hard work to die. And my blessed mom, I just love her so much. I talk to her all the time. I'm so blessed to be sober. I'm so blessed to be the person that I am. I'm so blessed to have the history that I do. It allows me to be useful to a lot of women. I'm very proud of who I am today, and not in a prideful way, but in a grateful way. I'm married to a man who is my best friend. Bob treats me like a queen. And I treat him like a king, and he deserves it. He sent me a text right before I got up here to talk, and he said, you be sure and thank those people for treating my baby really good. And so, God bless you all. Thank you.